Innovative information-based radio, broadcasting to the people who really listen to shortwave. This is Radio Facts, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime.
Surround sound monitoring for television by Mark Young and John Fisher in International Broadcast Engineer. For several years, broadcasters around the world have been experimenting with, and in some cases using, new transmission systems to provide stereo sound with their pictures. Since 1982, many video cassettes and video discs have provided just such stereo soundtracks. More recently, the concept of surround sound with the television picture, similar to that enjoyed by cinema audiences, using these same stereo transmission channels, has also begun to catch television producers' imagination. A format for such transmissions already exists, known as Dolby Surround. Unlike the quadrophony formats for music recordings in the 1970s, there is already a substantial base of existing surround material available and in regular use, as well as a wide choice of domestic decoding equipment. Dolby Laboratories has recently introduced the model SDU4 surround decoder unit for professional use in monitoring material for broadcast and video applications, and this article describes its practical application. A number of countries are on the verge of introducing stereo sound with their television pictures, while a few have already done so. Stereo sound can enhance the enjoyment of a wide range of programmes: drama, music, sport, entertainment, possibly even some news material. Existing stereo sound formats for television, like those for disc and audio cassette reproduction, use two channels for recording, transmission and replay. The digital system, currently supported by the EBU for new systems within Europe, permits the stereo channel to be separated into two low crosstalk mono channels for second language programming. These stereo systems, like stereo radio, stereo discs, and stereo cassettes, are essentially intended to use two loudspeaker channels to reproduce the stereo image in front of the listener. Sounds originating between the stereo extremes are reproduced as phantom images created by common elements of the signal in both channels, the position varying with the relative proportion of the signal in each channel. For a listener placed centrally in the listening area, a phantom image of a central source will be reproduced by equal signals in both channels. However, if a listener is seated to one side of the central listening position, he will tend to perceive central sources as displaced towards the loudspeaker nearer to him. This is normally not serious for music, nor for radio drama, since there is no visual image to conflict with the oral image. Sitting reasonably close to the ideal central position may not be too difficult when listening to a well-set-up hi-fi system. When listening with pictures, the range of seating positions and listening angles is typically much wider, and the possible distortion of the positioning of central sources much greater, particularly for someone sitting well to one side. This potentially gives rise to serious clashes between the oral and visual stimuli. Dialogue normally originates from visual images which are fairly central, and a displacement of the perceived location of the voice to one side of the screen can be very disturbing. For this reason, stereo reproduction systems in the cinema, which has a long tradition of stereo sound, have traditionally used at least three loudspeakers across the width of the screen. This provides improved localization, with dialogue fed mainly to the central speaker or speakers, so that it matches more closely the visual image. Stereo sound formats in the cinema have often included, in addition, effects or atmosphere channels to the rear of and around the audience. There have been various cinema formats, but the most common has been the use of four channels: left, centre and right screen channels, plus a broadly distributed rear or surround channel. Originally, these four, or sometimes six, channels had to be recorded discreetly on separate magnetic tracks on the film, or even on a separate optical soundtrack print run in sync with the picture. Such solutions were always expensive and often clumsy. Magnetic tracks required individual real-time duplication of the soundtrack on each print after photographic processing. This was expensive by comparison with the standard mono soundtrack, which can be duplicated at high speed at the same time as the picture. More than a decade ago, Dolby Laboratories introduced the Dolby Stereo process for the cinema, using a stereo variable area optical soundtrack in the same position on the film as the standard dual bilateral mono soundtrack. The two-channel recording is matrix-encoded to provide left, centre, right and surround channels when reproduced through a suitable decoder. It can also be replayed compatibly on mono systems. For correct performance in the cinema, the system also uses complementary encode-decode noise reduction, plus equalisation of the sound head and loudspeakers in the reproducing chain. This process reduces costs dramatically by comparison with the use of discrete magnetic soundtracks. Such magnetic soundtracks have virtually disappeared for all but a few premium 70mm prints, and the recent emergence of Dolby SR encoded optical prints may displace even these as far as sound quality is concerned. Dolby Surround. A similar process, Dolby Surround, has been developed for television using two recording and transmission sound channels to convey information for surround reproduction. Initially, this was conceived as a means of reproducing in the home full surround sound from stereo broadcasts and videos of films whose soundtracks had been made in Dolby Stereo. However, such has been the interest in this consumer surround format that an increasing number of special Dolby surround productions are now being made for television and video. Because not all listeners will initially be equipped for Dolby Surround, and also because a matrix system is used, it is important that the production is carefully monitored, not only for surround reproduction, but also for suitability for conventional two-channel reproduction and mono. The Dolby SDU4 surround decoder unit is a matrix decoder and monitor switching unit, which enables this requirement to be met easily in studios, otherwise equipped only for conventional stereo monitoring. For many television stations, the most readily available material with stereo soundtracks has been in the form of cinema feature films and music videos. During transfer of a Dolby stereo film to videotape for broadcasting or for video mastering, the composite stereo film tracks are Dolby A or Dolby SR decoded, which permits correct monitoring, and the tape encoded as required. The centre and surround information will remain embedded in the left and right channels of the transmitted or recorded soundtrack. It may be recovered in the home environment using a special Dolby surround decoder, which performs a similar function to the matrix decoding that takes place in a Dolby stereo processor in the cinema. Dolby surround is essentially a format for domestic reproduction, retaining the surround reproduction capabilities of Dolby stereo without the standardization of the specialist reproduction environment inherent in the latter. For instance, Dolby Stereo uses standardized listening levels and frequency response calibration to ensure that what is heard in the cinema is very close indeed to what the film director heard in the mixing studio. In the home, listening levels and frequency response will inevitably vary, and the dynamic range available via broadcast television or video is likely to be less than that available in the cinema. Dolby Surround, therefore, does not have a calibrated listening level requirement. Though the normal professional requirements for a wide frequency response and dynamic range still apply to Dolby Surround monitoring in the studio. Since Dolby A type or SR type decoding will have been carried out prior to broadcast or video transfer, the noise reduction decoding, which forms part of the cinema Dolby stereo processor, is not part of the Dolby surround decoding. At present, there are over 600,000 domestic Dolby surround decoders in use worldwide, manufactured under license. They enable the listener at home to recreate the sound field in a very similar way to that experienced in the cinema. Surround decoders are available both as standalone adapters for existing stereo equipment and as integral parts of video replay and television receiver systems, linked to hi-fi speakers and amplifiers. They are an extension of the home entertainment center. Since the rear loudspeakers will handle mainly atmospheres and effects, rather than more critical speech and music, they need not be as extended in frequency range as the front loudspeakers, a practical benefit in both the control room and for home reproduction. For the latter, some of the very compact, good quality speakers now available, some self-powered, can prove attractive solutions. An even distribution of the sound has been found to be more important in the surround speakers than a wide response. Like Dolby Stereo in the cinema, the production of television video programs in Dolby Surround is a complementary process. The front, left, center and right and surround information is encoded on two transmission channels and is decoded again during replay. Because the television screen often subtends a smaller angle in the normal home environment than does the screen in the cinema, a center channel can be less critical. In the cinema, the center channel is essential in order to tie dialogue, for instance, firmly to the screen, regardless of seating position. If the front loudspeakers at home are not too widely spaced in relation to the screen, a centre speaker may not be necessary, though it may be helpful. The phantom centre produced by the left and right speakers, as for stereo music reproduction, may be adequate. If a little care is taken during monitoring of a special Dolby surround production, as is the case with a Dolby stereo film, there will be a high degree of compatibility with mono or two-channel conventional stereo reproduction. For several years, stereo prints of films made in Dolby Stereo have been transmitted in mono. Film buyers who have been looking ahead to future stereo broadcasting have been purchasing stereo prints, with the advantage of lower distortion on the soundtracks, even when reproduced in mono. Similarly, Dolby surround video cassettes transferred from films in Dolby Stereo are compatible with reproduction via mono players and television sets. Use of the SDU4 in a television or video film preview theatre, as well as in a film transfer facility, allows a Dolby Stereo film or Dolby surround videotape to be correctly monitored. Continuing with Surround Monitoring for Television by Mark Young and John Fisher. Correct monitoring of a Dolby surround television or video production is important, as it is with a Dolby stereo film production. For this purpose, Dolby Laboratories has recently developed its professional Dolby SDU4 surround decoder unit. installed in a television sound control room whose electroacoustical response conforms to wide-range monitoring standards, it permits reference surround monitoring. It also facilitates checks on two-channel and mono compatibility via four or three loudspeaker channels. The SDU4 provides a simple interface between the signal source and the monitoring system. It is very easy to align. The rack-mounted unit contains a 2-4 matrix decoder similar to that used in the Dolby stereo monitoring equipment found in film production studios. The 2-4 decoder accepts two-track matrix encoded signals, Dolby Surround or Dolby Stereo, as its inputs, and generates four output signals, left, center, right, and surround. The matrix system in the SDU4 incorporates active steering, identical to that used in Dolby stereo processors, to improve directional performance. Consequently, it is important that the composite left and right source channels, referred to as left total, right total, or LT and RT, are accurately balanced to ensure that dialogue and other central sources are steered correctly to the centre. The SDU4 incorporates LED indicators for ease of level setting and thus achieving correct balance. The SDU4 will handle the sound output of any reasonably phase-stable stereo source. Stereo or surround video, stereo broadcast, a surround-encoded mixer output, or the monitor output from the stereo preamplifier and noise reduction units of a film transfer system after noise reduction decoding. It is intended for monitoring via four loudspeaker channels, left, center, right, and surround, but may be configured internally for monitoring via three channels, left, right, and surround, where this is more convenient. When monitoring via three channels only, the steered center channel produced by the matrix is redistributed to the left and right channels. For the surround channel, it is desirable to use at least two loudspeakers and preferably more. Unlike quadrophony, the aim is not to produce localization of sounds from the rear and the sides, but to enhance the sense of space away from the screen. For this, it has been found that a multi-speaker arrangement for the surround channel helps spread the sound and avoid any localization of the surround information. Like a Dolby Stereo Cinema processor, the SDU4 contains an adjustable delay in the surround channel. This is designed to improve the perceived separation between the front and surround channels using the Haas effect. Without a delay, leakage of center-front dialogue into the surround channel would appear as noticeable and distracting crosstalk, particularly for listeners seated near the surround speakers, who would tend to hear the crosstalk before the main signal. By delaying the surround signal slightly, the dialogue from the front will always be heard first from the front loudspeakers, establishing a direction for the source that will not be disturbed by the later arrival of crosstalk in the surround loudspeakers. The surround channel contains additional modified B-type processing to reduce noise and improve front-to-rear separation. Unlike the Dolby Stereo Cinema processor, the SDU4 does not include Dolby A-type or SR decoding, since some sources may not be encoded in this way, and others will have had noise reduction or SR decoding carried out already. When monitoring the transfer of a Dolby stereo film, A-type noise reduction or SR decoding will normally have been carried out via a standalone processor connected to the output of the model OPU1 preamplifier used with the optical sound head. Surround sound for television, the final part. The SDU4 includes a calibration aid using a pink noise generator to assist in setting and checking monitoring levels. Noise can be cycled automatically between left, centre, right and surround, remaining for 3 seconds at each output. Or it may be alternated between centre and surround every 3 seconds. Pink noise may also be switched to any channel under manual control. Preset controls provide adjustment of individual channel outputs, and there is a single knob overall 4-channel master level control. A detent position on this fader can be set to provide a normalised listening level. An alternative remote control facility for the master fader is also provided. This not only ensures that all operating levels within the SDU4 unit remain correct, which would not be the case if the input level were adjusted to vary the 4-channel output, but also makes it easier to provide surround monitoring in any television studio originally equipped for 2-channel monitoring, with the addition of surround and optional centre speakers and amplifiers. In addition to the level meters for the composite left and right input channels, LT, RT, there are confidence signal present LED indicators for the left, centre, right and surround outputs to confirm the nature of the material being monitored. Various operating modes are possible. Dolby surround, conventional stereo or mono may be selected by front panel push button or remote control. This facility provides flexible monitor switching arrangement for 3 or 4 loudspeaker channels, so it is capable of interfacing with specific replay environments. Internal logic allows program material to be reproduced correctly with or without a center loudspeaker, though a center speaker may be required if the L and R front loudspeakers are widely spaced. Programs are already being mixed in the Dolby surround format in several countries, notably the USA, for transmission via stereo networks. Uptake of Dolby surround decoders has been rapid, over 500,000 in the USA alone. In particular, for the reproduction of video material, much of which has stereo soundtracks suitable for Dolby surround reproduction. Over 1,600 original feature films for the cinema have so far been produced in Dolby Stereo. When broadcast via a stereo television system or transferred to video cassette or video disc, Dolby Surround, the surround information embedded in the stereo soundtrack is available for reproduction in the home.
park my car, stake my place in the singles bar, face to face, toe to toe, heart to heart as we hit the floor, lumber up, limbo down, the locked embrace, the stumble around, I say go, she say yes, dim the lights, you can guess the rest. That buzz, love is the drug I'm thinking of. Oh, can't you see? Love is the drug got a hook in me. Oh, get that buzz, love is the drug I'm thinking of. Oh, can't you see? Love the drug for me.
This is Radio Facts, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime.
With Trevor Brook.
And Holly Robson.
The correspondence in The Independent, which Norman MacLeod has been raising about RDS, has been continuing, with a reply from Johnny Beerling of the BBC.
He writes to The Independent, "Dear Sir, Norman MacLeod is quite a remarkable listener in that he enjoys our somewhat old-fashioned AM broadcasts, but I doubt his views are shared by many listeners, judging by the sales of CD players, hi-fi stack systems and FM radios. The statement that radio data system is incredibly complicated and expensive is inaccurate. One of the design criteria was that it should lead to inexpensive receivers. As RDS receivers become more generally available, the price will not be that high and will fall further as mass production begins. Mr. MacLeod may choose to ignore the benefits of RDS, but perhaps he is unusual and can easily recall to memory the frequencies used by each of the 400 or so BBC radio transmitters and the 70 used by the Independent Broadcasting Authority for its radio services. Devotees will appreciate that RDS finds a station of their choice automatically and selects the optimum frequency. It will also confirm that selection unambiguously by providing a readout of the station name rather than meaningless numbers and abbreviations such as MHZ or KHZ. Mr. MacLeod may also have to spend a good deal of time of stationary in traffic jams, because without RDS he won't appreciate the advantages of an improved travel information service. This will be capable of providing him with local information about motoring and travel conditions, even while he's tuned in international radio. This travel service will be available shortly via RDS, as will the ability to select listening by the type of program required. One of the additional RDS features is an accurate clock and calendar, but this one never requires adjusting as it takes account of time zones in different countries and responds to winter and summer variations automatically. But the clock is not the reason for RDS, as Mr. MacLeod would have us believe. RDS is here, and it will make for fumble-free listening for all of our listeners."
And that was from Johnny Beerling. Norman MacLeod comes back with another letter to The Independent. "Dear Sir, I am pleased to hear from Mr. Beerling that radio data system is not complicated or expensive. My information is that an RDS coder will cost a radio station a minimum of £5,000. If RDS catches on, it will be very difficult to get an RDS-equipped radio to take any notice of stations which are not using RDS. The community stations I deal with abroad sometimes have only £5,000 to spend on their entire transmitting station. Therefore, RDS looks expensive to them, and it looks expensive to me. Although the BBC uses hundreds of VHF transmitters to cover the country, each network has its own place on the dial. You will get Radio 2 somewhere between 88.1 and 90.1, Radio 3 between 90.3 and 92.3, and Radio 4 between 92.5 and 94.5 almost everywhere. On AM, it is even simpler. There are only six main frequencies for all four networks, and even if Mr. Beerling finds them difficult to remember, they are printed on the radio page of this and most other newspapers. Yours sincerely, Norman MacLeod, Brighton.
Meanwhile, in The Times, Richard Evans reports that a search for a new head of the IBA fails. A desperate search by the government has failed to produce a new chairman of the Independent Broadcasting Authority to succeed Lord Thompson, who retires at the end of the year. Downing Street and Home Office officials are now openly worried about having a rudderless regulatory body in charge of Britain's commercial television network at such a crucial and sensitive time in broadcasting. Lord Thompson, aged 67, a former Labour minister and EEC Commissioner, took over the IBA hot seat in 1981 and had his term of office extended in 1986. Mr. Douglas Hurd, the Home Secretary, is understood to have privately sounded out Lord Thompson about continuing as IBA chairman until the authority is wound up by the government's broadcasting legislation in 1990, but was told no. Mr. Hurd would ideally like to find a member of the great and good who would take over as IBA chairman, wind down the authority, and be in charge of the successor body, a commercial television authority, which will be established by the government. Home Office officials have travelled far and wide in recent weeks for a suitable candidate with proven management skills and a knowledge of the media, and although various names have been floated, no candidate has been found. Sir Donald Maitland, a former ambassador and Downing Street press secretary to Mr. Edward Heath, has been vice-chairman of the IBA since 1986 and is the obvious candidate to step in as acting chairman.
From Communication World International, launch date set. The launch date for the first satellite of the French Télédiffusion de France programme has been set. It is scheduled to take off on the 28th of November on the Ariane launch vehicle from Kourou in French Guiana. The TDF-1 was built to transmit direct broadcasting services using the D2MAC norm and is supposed to spur development of high-definition television in Europe. The launch has been delayed and rescheduled several times because of controversy surrounding the satellite's technology and its financing.
Sound that flows into my mind. The echoes of the daylight.
This is Radio Fax, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime. If you'd like a copy of the specially printed QSL card and a six-page information sheet by return of post, please send 50 pence in British stamps or three international reply coupons to Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG.
And from Ireland, the Irish Press. Mixed reception as radio group named by Sean O'Rourke. The Radio and Television Commission has been announced and includes several people prominent in entertainment and broadcasting, and some connected with Fianna Fáil. They will meet for the first time next Monday in the stately Newbridge House near Donabate, North County Dublin, following their appointment by Communications Minister Ray Burke. The Commission will get up to £500,000 for start-up expenses, but must pay its own way after 1990 from contract fees. As revealed exclusively by the Irish Press last week, the chairman is Mr. Justice Seamus Henchy, who is retiring from the Supreme Court. While the Progressive Democrats viewed the composition as, quote, independent, Labour said it was, quote, the most blatant piece of political partisanship, unquote, since Mr. Burke was in charge of An Bord Pleanála in 1982. That's the Irish Planning Permission Board. The Commission will award a franchise for a new national commercial radio channel due on the air next spring and an independent television channel planned for next autumn. The legislation also allows for local and town commercial radio and neighbourhood stations run by volunteers. All pirate stations must be off the air by the end of this year. In addition to Mr. Justice Henchy, the Commission members are Vivian Murray, Chief Executive of the Irish Goods Council, Donal O'Sullivan, Programme Manager, Southern Health Board, Terry Prone, Director, Car Communications, Frank Cullen, Public Relations Company Owner, Fred O'Donovan, Entertainment Impresario, Kieran Mulvey, General Secretary of ASTI, Liam Devely, Barrister and former RTE Presenter, Gillian Bowler, Managing Director, Budget Travel, Donna O'Donoghue, Chief Executive, Thomas McGroup.
From the Financial Times, Britain threatens to pull out of Europe TV Pact, written by Raymond Snoddy. The government warned the Council of Europe that it will not sign a proposed convention on transfrontier television unless controversial rules on advertising are modified. Mr. Timothy Renton, the Home Office Minister responsible for broadcasting, said in London that Britain could not accept regulations more restrictive than the UK was used to and which would effectively end advertising in natural breaks in programmes. In the draft convention, feature films shown on TV could, for instance, only be interrupted once by advertising, and other programmes only once for each complete 45 minutes. Mr. Renton believes this would damage the ITV system. He told a conference on the future of television organised by the Institute of European Trade and Technology, if current restrictions are not modified, the UK will not be prepared to ratify the convention. It would be too harmful to our broadcasting interests, and the convention will be significantly weaker as a result. A possible compromise which may allow Britain to sign the convention at a meeting of the 21 nations of the Council of Europe in Stockholm next month was held out yesterday. Mr. Andries Overs, chairman of the Council of Europe Steering Committee, drawing up the draft directive, said Britain should take a pragmatic approach. He said it would be possible for Britain to enter a reservation to the convention which would allow the ITV companies to continue with the existing advertising system. However, the Dutch civil servant emphasised that satellite television channels originating from Britain would have to meet the full requirements of the convention if they wanted a passport to all the cable networks of Europe. The UK has suggested that the restrictions on advertising should either be relaxed or countries should have the option of choosing whether they wanted a system of natural break advertising or not. Britain supports the concept of a convention so that a basic legal framework is in place to prevent the broadcasting of violent or pornographic programmes. Mr. Renton said that it would not be the end of the world if Britain did not participate in a convention. Satellite services could be controlled by penalising those who were involved in offensive channels.
Now that was the Financial Times and The Times covering the same story. Minister attacks European television plans by Andrew Billen, arts correspondent. Britain may refuse to sign two proposed European accords on broadcasting, said Mr. Timothy Renton, Minister of State at the Home Office. Speaking at an Institute of European Trade and Technology conference, he criticised European officials for trying to impose new restrictions rather than deregulate broadcasting in preparation for a single market in 1992. Referring to European demands for more cultural programmes to be broadcast, he said cultural dictatorship had no part to play in broadcasting policy. Basic standards apart, it is not the business of government to dictate what kind of material viewers should watch, he said. The government's main fears centre on two documents: the Council of Europe's draft convention on transfrontier broadcasting between 21 European states, due to be ratified in Stockholm next month, and the EEC's draft directive on broadcasting. The convention proposes ending natural breaks in most commercial television programmes, restricting them to once every 45 minutes in others, and replacing them with longer blocks of advertising. Mr. Renton said viewers' disinclination to watch long segments of commercials would reduce advertising revenue and force broadcasters to abandon programmes prohibited from interruption. He recommended that the new rules should apply only to television services that donated more than 15% of time to advertising. If the current restrictions are not modified, the United Kingdom will not be prepared to ratify the convention, he said. In a final assault on European plans, he criticised a community media programme for projects to help programme distribution, production, training and financing. If there is a need for action to strengthen the competitiveness of the European audiovisual industry, then it is a matter for the industry itself rather than for governments or the European community, said Timothy Renton.
From the media file in The Guardian, Peter Fiddick tells us that rivalry between the satellite bosses is warming up nicely and fully 4 months to go before any of them shows us a picture. Last week, apparently, there was a spat between BSB and Sky, with Alan Sugar on a phone-in over how big anyone's receiving dish will need to be. Then off goes BSB chief executive Anthony Simmons-Gooding to Brighton, where, as for Labour in Blackpool, his outfit was sponsoring the Tory conference big screen setup to chat to the Bow Group. Can it be right, he ponders, that Robert Maxwell, with his established press power, or Rupert Murdoch, who already controls over a third of our national newspapers, should be allowed to add television channels to this massive power? Good question. Still, he's surely going over the top with the next bit. Furthermore, the unique prominence given to Sky Television in News International's newspapers and the seeming mixing of promotional references with editorial matter must give rise to doubts about whether News International's objectivity may be undermined by their wider commercial interests. Mr. Murdoch assures me that this is not so. Has anyone else noticed it? Sure. Messrs. Murdoch and Simmons-Gooding have common cause, though, on one front, the threat of Broadcasting Standards Council. BSB is going to offer parents an electronic lock so that they can stop the kiddies viewing anything unsuitable. Also, like Sky Movie, its feature film channel will be subscriber only. Altogether now, it is important that the BSC, in drawing up its intended code, recognises the importance of parental control mechanism and also the distinction between subscription services, for which a consumer specifically pays, like video, and those services which are freely available on the public service channels.
I seen a girl on a one-way corridor, stealing down a wrong-way street, for all the world like an urban toreador. She had wheels on heartbeat. And the cars do the usual dance. Same old crews in the curbside crawl. But the roller girl, she's taking chances. I just love to see her take them all. No fear alone at night, she's sailing through the crowd. Enemies are forced to tighten and the music's playing loud. Hallelujah, here she comes, Queen Rollerball. And on Shanti, can I say, care at all? You know, she used to have to wait around. She used to be the lonely one. But now that she can skate around town, she's the only, only one. No fear, alone at night, she's sailing through the crowd. Did her ears just fold so tight and the music's playing loud. She gets rock and roll in a rock and roll station, in a rock and roll dream. She's making movies on location. She don't know what it means. And the music maker wanna be the story. And the story was whatever was the song, what it was. Roller girl, don't worry. DJ play the movie. All night long, all night long. She tortures taxi drivers just for fun. It's like read their lips. Toro, Toro taxi, see you tomorrow, my son. So she let a big truck grease her hip. Oh, she's got a whole world in the sea, yeah. Can't even shoot on her, no, no, no. She got her own world in the city. The city's been so rude to her. She is alone at night, sailing through the crowd. So tight and the music's playing loud. She gets rock and roll in a rock and roll station, in a rock and roll dream. She's making movies on location. She don't know what it means, but the music make her wanna be the story. And the story was whatever was the song, what it was. Slipping in the slide. Skate away. That's all. We'll be right back.
Now we've had a letter from Des Walsh, who lives in Carrigaline in County Cork. Wonderful part of the country, and that's somewhere in the centre of Southern Ireland. I have been listening to your daytime and evening transmissions for some time and am very interested to hear your various transmissions. You may be interested in the subject of MMDS here in Ireland. MMDS is Microwave Distribution of Television Services. For some years, there have been various private and community-run self-help UHF deflector systems bringing United Kingdom television channels to rural areas outside the cable cities and large towns. These unauthorised systems are mainly in the south, southwest, and west regions where overspill of United Kingdom UHF does not occur. For over 10 years, these have existed with the odd raid where signals were encroaching on licensed cable operators. Now, as the cable operators had no permission from the BBC and IBA, or specifically from the Irish government for United Kingdom channels, the deflector operators are aggrieved that the government calls them pirate, when the cable operators are really pirates too. For the last decade, governments never made up their minds in court, as it was always a hot political local issue in rural Ireland. Now, they have decided to allow 2.5 GHz MMDS, or MMVS, microwave television with up to 11 channels, the only must-carry being the third proposed third national channel. Experts in propagation are pointing out that coverage can only be abysmal, taking into account most of rural Ireland's hilly terrain. But the government are content to plough ahead. Some £250,000 for each cell of 10 to 30 kilometres hoped-for range is envisaged, and probably with scrambling to stop piracy. The hopes of a vibrant MMDS 2.5 GHz export potential for Irish manufacturers is being trotted out by the government, but business experts poo-poo the idea as being out of touch with reality. So far, the medical effects of up to 17 kilowatts effective radiated power at 2.5 gigahertz have not been discussed. But when residents near the proposed cells realise that the equivalent of 20 microwave ovens will be radiating omnidirectionally down on them continually, hell hath no fury as a slowly cooked individual. Thank you very much for that interesting contribution, Des Walsh, who says, hope you continue from strength to strength. Des Walsh from Carrigaline, County Cork in the Republic of Ireland.
Meanwhile, the Irish press has this to say about MMDS. Cable chief doubtful over new satellite TV network. With only a few weeks to go before the government decides who will get franchises for the new satellite and third channel broadcasting, a Midlands cable operator says there are serious doubts about the technical feasibility of the new network, and in particular, whether the third channel will be available in all parts of the country. The minister's ambitions include a multi-point microwave distribution system, MMDS, network to cover the country. It would also be a vehicle to bring a third Irish channel to viewers across the country. It was also designed to stop pirate rebroadcasters of British channels. In the past, some of these have even had their equipment returned to them after conviction in court. There are only three ways in which the third channel could be distributed, according to Doug Armstrong, who operates two cable franchises in the Midlands. One, leapfrogging, cascading. One MMDS operator would pass his signal on to the other, thus creating a network across the country. This method is uncertain. If one operator suffers a breakdown, the whole country might be without reception, experts claim. In the initial stages, operators in country areas would be relying on East Coast systems to come on stream at the same time as themselves. 2. RTE would be compelled to provide microwave links for MMDS at its own transmitter sites, some industry sources speculate. The department denies this. RTE might thus give facilities to a competitor. The sites being already serviced with roads and power would be far cheaper than greenfield operations. 3. Fibre optics. This is possibly the most likely, although it could prove very expensive. Telecom Aeron would provide leased lines to MMDS operations, carrying all the required channels, including the third Irish one. The department is confident that it has got the attention of a lot of serious people. License applications show that people are prepared to put a lot of money into MMDS, said a department source. Applicants for the 29 main MMDS transmitter primary licences have been from major operators. Cablelink is believed to have applied for 6 franchises in Dublin, Waterford, Galway and some in East Midlands. Cork Communications, partly Finnish-owned, is looking for 3 licences. Westwood in Limerick is looking for 3 or 4. Shaw Noir is looking for 3 or 4 in the South Midlands. The department has recommended that blocks of licences be applied for, thus non-viable transmitter in Longford might connect one with Mullingar. A total of 10 or 12 independent newspapers is believed to have put in for 10 to 12 primary cell. Telecom Aeron, also bidding to buy Cablelink, has applied for a number of franchises. The cost structure of MMDS has proved prohibitive for many smaller cable operations. The Irish press has spoken to several who have researched the area in depth and found it was not viable. The cost up front of equipment would be well over £300,000, a department source agreed. Roughly half of this will be spent on the transmitter. The rest would go on decoding equipment at the users' homes. There would also be an upfront licence fee to the department of £20,000 plus an annual fee, similar to cable. There have been problems getting money out of some cable operators, so a guarantee of up to £500,000 may have to be shown. MMDS covers a customer base which is much less concentrated than cable. It might extend over a radius of 30 miles, making servicing much more expensive. The charges to each customer are likely to be higher than cable. Doug Armstrong predicts that there will be a typical connection fee of £200 and a rental of £130 per customer per year after that. The department disputes this. This includes VAT at 25% and a 5% levy to the Minister for Communications. Amstrad will sell competing satellite dishes for £199 sterling from next February. BBC and ITV are currently available on satellite. A considerable number of areas won't be able to receive the signal directly from the transmitter, it's claimed. MMDS will only work in areas that can actually see the transmitter. Valleys, hills and trees will all be impediments to the receiving of MMDS and thus the third channel. Trees have been proving particularly problematic in tests, according to our sources. Some of those who have tested equipment report intermodulation problems, using it to transmit 11 channels simultaneously. One channel interferes with another. These difficulties can be overcome, but not cheaply. The machinery is very specialised, and it's doubtful if there are more than a handful of engineers here at present capable of maintaining it, some smaller cable operators maintain. The whole area of encoding is also a minefield. Pirated decoders are easily available in Dublin now for satellite broadcasts. It does not seem too far-fetched to assume that ways will also be found to pirate decoding devices for MMDS. This puts a question mark over the viability of the new system, said one expert. The department counts that it is possible to install a system where a code is changed once a week or once a month. A government source is also claiming that installing pirate equipment would be significantly more expensive than MMDS. When the Minister Burke mentioned his new broadcasting system to the Fianna Fáil Ardvoice, he said that it was at the edge of technology and would have considerable export potential. In fact, Ireland will not be leading developments in this field, some in the industry maintain. We will be using what will in fact be an old frequency, 2.5 gigahertz. In the US, they are using 2.5 gigahertz. However, the system in Britain will use 13 gigahertz. The Irish frequency, if used abroad, will interfere with military and some domestic communications, claim some critics. So any antenna or block converters made in Ireland would be unlikely to have any export potential, some claim. This may well be a defunct system, which won't sell abroad and has doubtful viability at home, says Doug Armstrong. These changes are all rejected by the Department of Communications. All of the proposed combinations of MMDS cells will include at least one satisfactory reception point, said a source close to the department. A cascade or leapfrogging arrangement is also feasible, he maintained. It is not expected that RTE would be compelled to provide facilities for MMDS, says the department. 2.5 gigahertz is the established frequency in the United States and is going to be a worldwide industry standard, the department claims. This will allow for employment possibilities in the manufacture of equipment. The higher the frequency you use, the more difficult reception is, said the source. The department freely admits that the costs will be quite substantial. However, it claims that charges to customers will not radically differ from the £100 connection fee and £100 per year rate predicted some months ago by Minister Burke. Intermodulation is a problem with all broadcasting, sources close to the department say. You could build it into your cost structure. Radio Facts, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime.
And the same thing again, but with a different acronym, M3VDS, the cheapest, quickest and least obtrusive means of providing multi-channel domestic television, by M. Pilgrim, R.P. Searle and R.P.I. Scott, who are all from British Telecom Research Laboratories. That's at Martlesham Heath, near Ipswich, in England. This is one of the papers presented at the International Broadcasting Convention. We advocate a new means of delivering multi-channel television to the home, using the as-yet untapped millimetre wave region of the radio spectrum, a millimetre wave multi-channel multi-point video distribution service, M3VDS, would be compatible with satellite broadcasting and complementary to cable television by assisting expansion of fringe area coverage and economic infilling. In addition, it offers an early and rapid expansion of the customer base for programming, since service can be quickly established over the complete coverage area without disruptive major engineering work. Recent gallium arsenide monolithic integrated circuit developments are the key to the system, now enabling cost-effective millimeter wave receivers to be built. Principal feature is the transmitter, sited at a local high point and associated with the head end, which controls a program mix drawn from TVRO and DBS satellites at several orbit positions, off-air UHF television channels, cable television programs extending nearby cable system, taped programs injected at the head end, high-definition television when available, and local interest programs. Using millimeter wave transmission, for example at 29 GHz or 39 GHz, the transmitter would serve an area approximately 2 km in diameter. Typically, this will encompass between 5,000 and 10,000 households. Coverage will be determined by considerations of transmitter power, antenna gain, receiver sensitivity, grade of performance required, and line of sight limitations due to trees, buildings, etc. A customer at the edge of the coverage area would receive a picture quality better than CCIR grade 4 for 99.9% of all time. Compare the DBS target of better than grade 4 for 99% of the worst month. Under normal conditions, grade 4.5 picture or better would be achieved. If neither high-definition television nor extended definition television were required, then the same performance could be achieved over about 3.5 kilometres diameter. The installation at the customer's home comprises an antenna, which is a small unobtrusive reflector of about 15 centimetres diameter, or a printed array of similar area. Integral with it is the down converter, which employs gallium arsenide monolithically integrated chips. The signal passes via a down lead to the indoor receiver, which is of the type already in volume production for satellite reception. The intermediate frequency and power feed requirement of the M3VDS down converter are chosen to ensure this compatibility. Between 10 and 30 channels can be carried, selected to meet market requirements, whilst remaining compatible with channel spacing, spectrum availability, and frequency reuse objectives. For example, 20 channels spaced at multiples of 19.18 MHz, as used for direct broadcasting satellite service, could be chosen. The system can easily be configured for either PAL or MAC formats, and is transparent to conditional access. The millimeter wave spectrum offers sufficient bandwidth potential to handle extended definition and high definition television transmissions when these become available. Small and medium towns, approximately 10,000 to 100,000 population, parts of towns and large villages, many of which are unlikely to be cabled this century, constitute a market singularly suited to M3VDS. In the UK, this constitutes a potential market of over 6 million homes. A further application has been identified in existing cable franchises, both to infill, where cabling may prove uneconomic or environmentally difficult, and to extend and complete coverage around the fringes. The potential for systems and hardware of this type in markets outside the UK will vary according to local regulatory positions and spectrum availabilities. Prospects should be good, because in most countries, use of the millimetre wave spectrum is only just beginning to be addressed. A large proportion of M3VDS capital cost relates directly to the number of customers served, as opposed to passed. This has economic advantages, where only a small proportion of customers passed take up the service, which can be less than 25% for some United Kingdom new build systems. Detailed market surveys have shown us that M3D VDS is economically viable when set in the context of equipment costs and the television consumer market. Use of a standard satellite indoor receiver handling either PAL or MAC at will gives economy of scale to both M3 VDS and satellite television. Some features of M3 VDS that will benefit the customer. It offers a wide program base of cable plus installation flexibility of DBS. Channels from more than one satellite can be viewed without the need for multiple or steerable antennae. In addition, households with more than one television set can view different programs simultaneously via simple splitter and amplifiers without the need for extra antennae. Complete system can be installed with negligible disruption and unpopular civil engineering works. The visual impact of the 15-centimetre antenna is substantially less than that of conventional UHF television Yagis or of that needed for DBS, making it environmentally acceptable. A small antenna has much reduced wind loading, eliminating risk of mounting problems. Even the smallest envisaged DBS antenna, 30 centimetres in diameter, would give difficulties in many towns in the UK. A 15-centimetre diameter unit quarters the wind loading. And finally, it has the intrinsic capability of carrying extended and high-definition television. The system advantages are that with careful market and technical planning, the overall costs of the system are more predictable than those of cable, there being fewer unknowns, such as, for example, duct blockage. Because of the lower startup costs, M3 VDS can show a profit earlier than an equivalent cable system. Expansion of the customer base encourages investment in program making, which is a prerequisite for the success of the television market generally, but in particular for cable and DBS. Advanced coverage of parts of a cable franchise prior to cabling is possible. Radio equipment, transmitters and receivers can be recovered and used elsewhere. The system offers advantages in comparison with MMDS systems operating at around 2 GHz. Use of millimetre waves offers the potential to carry up to 30 channels, including high-definition television. By comparison, spectrum availability severely limits MMDS, and only a few channels are possible. In addition, by careful planning, millimetre wave frequencies can be reused, at best within a few hundred metres, and at worst within a few tens of kilometres, depending on the configuration. At 2 GHz, the reuse distance could exceed 150 kilometres. And the disadvantages. Line-of-sight transmission path can be blocked by trees and tall buildings. Nevertheless, our experience shows that typically 70 to 80% of homes in the main service area can be reached directly. Others can be served by master antenna TV local distribution via cable from a single receiver, for example along terraces or within apartment blocks. Interactivity will not be available initially, a limitation shared with the tree and branch cable of most current new build installations. Advancing radio technology may permit a limited capacity return channel later. However, economics presently tend not to favour interactive systems, whether switch star cable or radio. The monolithic down converter in the customer's outdoor unit is the key to an affordable product. At the British Telecom Research Laboratories, technologists have for some time been engaged in extending gallium arsenide monolithic microwave integrated circuit capability to include analogue circuits up to about 40 GHz. 29 GHz monolithic mixers and IF amplifiers are already installed in our field demonstrator system. Work is progressing fast towards fully integrating 29 GHz and 39 GHz down converters designed for use with existing proprietary satellite indoor receivers. In quantities of 100,000 off, fully tested and packaged down converters are expected to cost only a few tens of pounds. Together with the antenna, either reflector or flat plate, the total installed cost of the customer's receiving equipment, excluding the television set, will be comparable with that of a functionally similar 12 GHz DBS installation. In the spring of this year, British Telecom opened an M3 VDS field demonstrator system at Saxmundham in Suffolk. The purpose of this trial is threefold. One, to demonstrate the feasibility of delivering multi-channel TV to the home by millimetre waves. Two, to investigate the practical aspects of installing and running the system. And three, to show that monolithic millimetre wave integrated circuit technology is ready to make production systems economic. Saxmundham was chosen because accommodation was available not only for the transmitting equipment, but also for display and demonstration areas. In addition, this town, with its mixture of housing types, is a microcosm of one type of market area identified as suitable for the M3 VDS product. The transmitter site at Saxmundham receives programmes from two satellites, initially Intelsat 5 and ECSF-1, plus the off-air UHF broadcasts. Up to 8 channels will then be transmitted over the M3 VDS system to around 10 homes in the town. Each trial participant will be supplied with a 15-centimetre antenna and down converter outside and a satellite receiver indoors, which will feed into his existing television set. As the trial progresses, new developments will be introduced, for example, fully integrated monolithic receivers and flat plate antennas. Taken with the continuing development work at British Telecom Research Labs, the demonstrator will create a pool of designs and technologies to facilitate a swift and effective transition into full-scale production. That paper given at the International Broadcasting Convention recently at Brighton.
You got me surging.
Now to some of your letters. We've heard from Mr. A. Radmore from Blackpool. He says, good reception here on a variety of receivers, from computer control to simple valve straight RXs.
And from the United States, I first heard about your station during a visit to the UK a couple of weeks ago, where, among other things, I attended the Communicate 88 convention. As your signal was generally the strongest, I thought I'd try it when I got back home, and sure enough, you were there. Reception was made about 125 kilometres northeast of New York City in Connecticut, USA, on a military surplus R390A receiver connected to a 40-metre long-wire antenna. The signal faded rapidly after 0830 GMT. Thank you very much, Greg Bears from Watertown, Connecticut, USA.
Over to Norway now, and a letter from Tor Johnny Bradvit from Norway. The reception quality changes from relatively good to almost excellent, but for most of the time with a better quality of reception on medium wave than on short wave. I've been listening to your radio station for several times recently, but it was first on last Thursday night that I finally sat down and wrote a reception report to you while I listened to one of your programmes. This letter will, of course, include the reception report, which I hope will be of interest to you. I'm living in a small village called Flaxvit, which is situated on the west coast of this country near the city of Bergen. I'm working at a printing house in downtown Bergen, where we produce braille books and periodicals for the blind. I work there as a proofreader, as I'm blind myself. Thanks for your letter, Tor Johnny Bradvit from Norway.
And Stan Jackson from Hesketh Bank in Preston, near Preston in England. A most interesting and informative range of topics, especially for shortwave listeners like myself. I had a good laugh at your lady announcer when she was enjoying herself trying to get the technical jargon on HF antenna development over to us listeners, but we won't talk about that. The signal up here on 6205 bent the needle on my S meter and was rock steady Q5 all the time. I look forward to hearing a lot more from your station in the near future. Thank you, Stan Jackson, Hesketh Bank.
To Leamington in Hampshire now, we've heard from Mr. K.E. Pierce, who says he enjoyed our talk about BBC Start Point transmitters, which we put out last month.
And from Cheltenham, I listened with interest and now have become hooked, listening on both 1611 and 6205 during the daytime. I spend some of my days working from home and therefore get the chance to monitor the daytime frequency. I look forward to receiving your Curacell card, not to mention many more hours listening to Radio Facts. Grant Cratchley from Cheltenham, Gloucestershire, England.
And thank you to W.D. Griffiths from Swansea for your report reception.
And people from the media, thank you, Donald Aldous, who writes in Hi-Fi News from Plimpton in Devon. And thank you, Fiona Waters, Head of Press and Publicity for Sky Channel Television Service. And Outlook Magazine, Ian Henshaw, also from The Face, and John Williams. An intriguing job advert. You've got 4 minutes to convince us you should be a local radio trainee reporter. If you're good, that's all you'll need. Talk for 4 minutes onto the tape we'll send you and convince us you should be interviewed. We'll be looking for voices from all sections of the community that listeners of local radio can warm to. That's of paramount importance. Selection is rigorous, but then so is the training. It's designed for determined individuals who are reliable and self-disciplined. Your starting salary will be £8,834. Still interested? Phone BBC Corporate Recruitment for your application pack. Telephone 01927 5799.